Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we've got the thriller writer Robert Harris talking about the Dreyfus Affair.
Thank you very much for that very kind introduction. I don't know where you get this idea that The Ghost was anything other than pure fiction from beginning to end. It's very nice to be here. I've heard this is a very professional festival. I couldn't have believed that you did your World War I Flanders Mud reenactment in the car park with such astonishing precision. Really amazing. I think I'm going to be here for at least 4 years. They told me I'd be out of here by Christmas, but I really don't believe it. So I'm here to talk about my latest book, but I've written 8 other novels, and I know that some people prefer one or the other. So while I'm here, I'm very happy to answer questions on any of the books or on the process of writing. So I'll try and leave plenty of time at the end for questions. It's a very strange thing being a writer, certainly in my kind of books. If anyone had ever told me 2 years ago or so that I would write a novel about the Dreyfus Affair, I would have looked at them with astonishment. It never occurred to me to do such a thing. It came about in an odd way. The novel that I wrote, which isn't about a former British Prime Minister called Tony Blair, was made into a film by Roman Polanski. And he called me at the end of 2011, beginning of 2012, and said, shall we collaborate on another project together? And I went over to Paris to see him. He said, you have an idea. I did have an idea. He liked it. We agreed we'd make that film. And then we went out to lunch, and I made the great mistake of casually saying, I see you've got a lot of books on the Dreyfus Affair in your office. Have you ever thought of making a film about that? I've always wanted to make a film about the Dreyfus Affair, he said. So I came back to Britain, and about a week later I got a call saying, forget the other idea, you know. I've got a real hard-on for the Dreyfus idea. I'm fine, listen. Each to your own. And so I, with somewhat heavy heart, I have to say, started looking at books on the Dreyfus Affair. I knew no more than the average person, I would think, about the affair. I knew a Jewish officer called Alfred Dreyfus at the end of the 19th century had been wrongly accused in France of being a spy, that he'd gone to Devil's Island, and that eventually he had been cleared and brought back. I knew that the affair went on for a long time and it involved a cast of hundreds of people. And really the last thing one wants is a story that goes on for, drags on for ages and involves a cast of hundreds. So I started looking at the story thinking that there's no way that there's a film can be made from this. And then I came across a man I'd never heard of before called Georges Picard. The youngest colonel in the French army. And as I read more about Picard, I realized that there was a way of doing this story, which wasn't the whole vast sweep of it, which was to do it as a espionage story, which is really what the Dreyfus Affair was at its heart. And so I went and saw Roman in Paris and said, I think we should do this as a spy story, a spy thriller, if you like. And he, whose interest had been more in the Dreyfus family, nevertheless, he accepted that idea. And I became so obsessed with Colonel Picard that after a couple of months, I said to Polanski, listen, I think this would make a much better novel, I'm afraid, than a movie. Could I do the novel first? And he said, fine, I'm very glad to say. And so I went away and started work. And for me, the novel is so infinitely superior as a means of communication to a movie, for me as a writer, that there is no contest. When I came across Picard, I wanted to get inside his head because I thought he was such a fascinating character. So you may ask, what is it about Picard that so fascinated me? Well, he was born in 1854 in Strasbourg. He was a man of Alsace. He came from a reasonably well-to-do Catholic family. His father died when he was quite young. When he was 16, the Franco-Prussian War occurred, and he was in Strasbourg when it was shelled. One of the first, I think the first, long-range modern artillery bombardment of a city caused widespread devastation and destruction. The French surrendered in 1870, and under the peace treaty, Alsace and Lorraine were occupied, well, indeed returned taken over by the Germans. And people had a choice. You could either stay where you were and become German, or you could be French, but you'd have to go and leave all your property behind. Picard's family left. He went to Paris, to Versailles, with his mother. They had no money. From being well-to-do, they suddenly became genteel poor. The only form of education that was open to him, really, was to join the army. Picard was an extremely clever man. He spoke six languages. He translated Russian. He read Dostoevsky in the original. He was a very cultured man. As a youth, he corresponded with Dostoevsky himself. He later became a great friend of Gustav Mahler. He was a fanatical Wagnerian, used to go to Bayreuth every year. He was an interesting man. He was not your typical soldier at all. He went to Saint-Cyr, the French academy, and graduated fifth out of his year. And he fought in North Africa and in Vietnam. He was decorated. He was a high flyer. There was no question of it. He was that curious scholar soldier, a rather attractive figure. He was a loner. He never married. I went recently to the office that he used to occupy in the Ministry of War for the French launch of my book, and was shown a photograph of Picard there. And he had a rather camp way of standing, slightly like Alan Clark, you know, over to one side. And there were a lot of rumours that Picard was gay, but I'm sure that he wasn't. He had a lot of affairs with married women, and a lot of those found their way into the police files. I'm sure if he'd had homosexual lovers, his enemies in the French government would have lost no opportunity of exposing that. So he's an interesting and attractive, remarkable figure. He was, he had the typical anti-Semitism of people of his religion and class, casual anti-Semitism, I suppose you would call it, which poses a difficulty for a modern novelist in a post-Holocaust world. He made a crack even about Dreyfus's degradation ceremony. He met Dreyfus, who was 5 years younger than he, at the École Supérieure de Guerre. Picard, as part of his high-flying career, was appointed a professor there when he was in his 30s, and he taught the young Captain Dreyfus topography. They didn't particularly know one another, and what they knew of one another, they didn't particularly get on. Dreyfus, curiously though, has a lot of similarities to Picard. He too was born in Alsace, but in Mulhouse, in the German-speaking region. His branch of his family also elected after the Franco-Prussian War to move to Paris. The difference was that most of Dreyfus's family stayed in Germany, or stayed in Mulhouse and became German, and because they had a textile factory there, and the money from the textile factory, a share of which belonged to Alfred Dreyfus's side of the family, the money came to him, and he had a very lavish lifestyle. His private income alone was 10 or 20 times the size of his pay as a French army officer. That, and the fact that he was Jewish, plus a certain aloofness perhaps in his manner, or shyness, hard to put one's finger on it, made him stand out somewhat and made him not particularly popular with his fellow officers. And it was for this reason that when the French secret service, intelligence service, realized there was a traitor was passing army secrets to the German embassy, suspicion fell upon Dreyfus. And Picard was recruited by the Minister of War and the Chief of the General Staff to help lull Dreyfus into a trap so that he could be arrested without his family knowing what had happened to him. Dreyfus was instructed to turn up in civilian clothes at the Ministry of War, and Picard met him, and because they knew one another, he conned him that he'd simply been brought in for a routine inspection. And poor Dreyfus, the door slammed behind him, and he was not to be seen again. Picard had taken over something called the stagiaire program at the French Defense Ministry, which essentially was that the high flyers from Sancerre, from the École Supérieure de Guerre, were given 6-month attachments in each of the 4 departments of the General Staff. And Dreyfus had completed 3 of those attachments and was on his 4th. So, if you like, Picard was his sort of supervising officer at the Ministry of War. Picard was, because now he was initiated into this great secret prosecution, he was sent by the French war minister, General Mercier, to be an observer for him personally at Dreyfus's secret court-martial. There were only 13 men in the room. One of them obviously was Dreyfus, and another one facing him across this small room throughout the 4 days was Georges Picard. And when Dreyfus was found guilty, Picard was sent by the same Minister of War to observe this terrible ceremony of degradation in Paris in January 1895, when Dreyfus had all the insignia of his rank torn from his uniform and his sword was snapped, a ceremony which took place in front of 5,000 or 6,000 French troops and also 20,000 French civilians, who turned out to watch the spectacle, which gives you some sense of the stakes involved and of the level of anti-Semitism in France at that time. There were shouts of death to the Jew and Judas, and Theodor Herzl, who was there as a reporter, it was one of the things that convinced him that the Jews had to have their own state. And led him to campaign for the establishment of Israel. So there was quite a lot hung on this particular event. And then Colonel Picard, or Major Picard as he then was rewarded for his diligence in these matters, in part of having shown himself a trusty, by being put in charge, amazingly, of the very unit, the very tiny secret unit that had investigated Alfred Dreyfus. He was promoted to colonel at the age of 40, making him the youngest colonel in the French army and putting him on track probably to be chief of the general staff himself. Certainly he would have been a general by the time he was 50. He went into this small unit that had tracked down Dreyfus, and here for the first time he walked through the looking glass into the world of... I thought it was me, but it's the Flanders reenactment continued. He walked through into the secret world of espionage, and he was made privy to some of the details about how the French army had lighted on Dreyfus as their suspect. The French had the best secret agent in the world, probably, at that time on their books, and she was a cleaner. She was the cleaner at the German embassy. More specifically, she cleaned the office of the German military attaché, Colonel von Schwarzkoppen. And he assumed that she was burning his rubbish, but in fact she was stuffing it under her skirts and bringing it to the French army, week in, week out. As a result of this, the French army knew that Colonel von Schwarzkoppen was having an affair with the wife of the Dutch ambassador and also with the Italian military attaché. He was nothing if not versatile, Colonel von Schwarzkoppen. And Picard discovered this. The man who was the liaison with Madame Bastien, which was the name of the cleaner, was a Major Henri, who had hoped to be in charge of the statistical section, as the secret unit was called, himself. But instead he found this, what he must have thought, Ponzi intellectual. promoted over his head. So there's a certain degree of tension from the start, which for me as a novelist is marvellous, because you can now begin to see what this character is doing. He's enabling me to go into the whole affair and to bring the reader in too. And as he learns the details of the story behind the Dreyfus affair, so we, the audience, can learn it at the same time. Picard took over the statistical section, ran it for about 9 months, and in that time he saw all the correspondence that poor Dreyfus was sending from Devil's Island, most of which never reached his wife. So the Dreyfus affair was continuing to run, and indeed Picard was continuing surveillance of the Dreyfus family and sympathisers, just in case there were more of these Jews out there preparing to undermine the French military. What had convicted Dreyfus, what had been taken from Schwarzkoppen's waste paper basket, was a very small, probably only about that size, piece of paper that had been torn into six pieces and then was glued back together by the French intelligence, by Major Henri, and it was the so-called bordereau. It was a list of five documents that had been passed to the Germans. It was unsigned. The handwriting seemed to suggest that this had been written by Captain Dreyfus. That was the only evidence against Dreyfus. About 9 months after Picard took over the statistical section, with the general feeling that they had the man on Devil's Island, or at least that's what he assumed, there was a fresh consignment of waste paper was delivered to the office, one of which was 40 or 50 fragments of tiny blue pieces of paper, which when glued back together recreated a pneumatic telegram, a petit bleu, as they were called in Paris. There was running, following the line of the French sewers under Paris, was a network of pneumatic tubes, and you could, rather like we used to have in department stores, you could fire a message from one side of Paris to the other in 30 minutes, and it was a way of quick communication. You bought your card, you paid 50 centimes for it, you wrote out your message, and you posted it. Well, this message had never left Schwarzkoppen. He'd written out the message and torn it into tiny fragments, having thought better of sending it and putting it in his bin, and this was what was recovered. It was pieced back together, and it turned out to be a communication between Schwarzkoppen and what was clearly an officer who was supplying intelligence. And when you turned it over, you saw the address was to Commandant Esterhazy, with an address in Paris. And you can imagine that for Picard, having been assured that Dreyfus was the guilty man, this was a moment of considerable importance, because clearly there was still a French army officer supplying information to the Germans. He started to mount a surveillance campaign on Esterhazy, and he took it into his own control. He didn't share it with the other members of the statistical section, which strongly suggests he was already beginning to feel a little uneasy about the people he was required to work with. This statistical section, which was only six or seven men, reminds me a bit of MI5 in the early 70s, as described by Peter Wright, a sort of out-of-control right wing bugging and burgling its way around the city outfit. And I think Picard began to realize he'd landed himself with a strange set of comrades. He continued this surveillance of Esterhazy, and he discovered that everything about Esterhazy fitted the likely author of the unsigned bordereau that had convicted Dreyfus. And the confirmation of his suspicions really came when there was a double agent who the French had operating in Berlin in the German military headquarters called Richard Kurz. And he came to the French military attaché in Berlin and said, Kurz tells us, Kurz said, you can see how complicated this is. Kurz said to the military attaché, the Germans have a spy in the French army. And not only that, they've never heard of Dreyfus. They've contacted all their allies as well, and they've never heard of Dreyfus either. When this information reached Picard, he now realized the scale of what he was dealing with, and he took his concerns to the chief of the French General Staff, General Boisdeffre. Now, Boisdeffre at that time was organising the greatest diplomatic coup in Europe, which was the visit of the young Tsar Nicholas to Paris. Indeed, 1.5 million Parisians turned out to see Nicholas and Alexandra when they drove through Paris in the spring of 1896, autumn of 1896. So he had other things on his plate, and the last thing he wanted to do was reopen the Dreyfus affair. Nevertheless, Picard persisted. And that really then gave me my novel, because what we had with Picard was a moral dilemma. Did he, as this high-flying officer, keep his mouth shut, do as he was told, and get the eventual promotion which would make him professional head of the French army, or did he do something about it? And really, my novel turns on that moral dilemma. In the end, I don't want to give the whole story away in case I can persuade some of you to buy a copy. But what happened was that Picard found himself suddenly turned into a kind of second Dreyfus. As he persisted with his inquiries, he himself was bundled off the case, ordered out of Paris, and effectively sent into exile. It's a terrific story, and far from being irrelevant to our modern age, I began to see how incredibly relevant it was and what a spectacular story it was, because Picard was sent to North Africa, realized his career was finished, and indeed the French General Staff tried to send him on a suicide mission to the Sahara, to near Tripoli, and at that point he realized they did not intend to him to leave North Africa alive, and he decided to break his oath of confidentiality. He provided information to a senior parliamentarian in Paris, and in the end, either directly or indirectly, to Emile Zola, who was campaigning for Dreyfus's release. And so Jacques was born directly out of Colonel Picard, and I certainly never knew that before I started work on this book, and I doubt whether anyone else does either. Most people who have heard of the affair, very few people would have made that connection. It's all very well having this character and having the story, but then for me as a novelist, it's necessary for me to try and find some way of turning it into a work of fiction. And I took two decisions with the book, which I think were crucial. One was that I decided to tell it in the first person. And I imagined to myself that Picard wrote his memoirs in around 1900, to be put in a bank vault and not read until a century after his death. And he died in January 1914, just before the First World War, and therefore January this year is the centenary of his death. That is not relevant to the novel at all. It doesn't really feature in the book, but it was a little key in my mind which made me help give me the voice and tone of the book, that he would be quite frank about his personal life and about officers and so on, because he wouldn't think that they'd ever read it. It was for future generations. That was a very liberating thing for me as a writer. I also decided to write it in the present tense. I know people get sick of this, historical novels written in the present tense, and I know what people mean, but nevertheless, it's a very good way of making a novel set in the past feel very immediate. Also, I felt, you know, that a lot of French newspapers and so on are written in the present tense, and I thought that I could get away with it in that way. The second decision I took was to not start the novel with Picard and Dreyfus meeting for the first time in the relationship of tutor and pupil, but to start it with the big public event, the degradation of Dreyfus in the centre of Paris, as witnessed by Picard, who then goes and describes what he's seen to General Mercier. This then made the degradation, if you like, the crime at the very beginning of the book. And then we follow Picard as he begins to solve or understand what has happened. And that meant that the things which I had to tell, the earlier story, the story of the the trial, for instance, the Dreyfus's court-martial, they suddenly had much more relevance and point if they were told in flashback, whilst Peacock was trying to fit together exactly what had happened. And what he fitted together was a story of almost breathtaking cynicism and corruption, because Dreyfus had been convicted on the basis of a secret file of evidence that Picard himself either handed to the judges or was involved in the chain that handed this closed file of evidence to the judges. And that must have weighed on his conscience, because when, as head of the statistical section, he finally called for the file and looked at it, he realised that it was simply a tissue of lies, forged documents. It must have been a stunning moment for him to realise that the man who was his deputy, the people along the corridor, the senior officers, the chief of the general staff to whom he was reporting, all these people were well aware of the flimsiness of the evidence with which they'd sent poor Dreyfus to Devil's Island for life. So by telling the story in that way, I turned it, I hope, and I tried to turn it into a work of entertainment and art, I hope. And that is really what one does as a novelist approaching history, that is different to the techniques that are generally used by historians who come to a festival like this. You know, we have license as novelists to do this kind of thing, and I think it has its value. I would never like to pretend that what I do is in any way comparable to the scholarship of a proper historian. Nevertheless, we can open a subject up. We can make it subjective. We can get inside Picard's head. A lot of my research involved reading the newspapers of the time. And you discover, for instance, that on the night that Dreyfus was sent to Devil's Island, was convicted and dispatched to Devil's Island, in the city of Paris, the city of light, that very night was the premiere of Debussy's L'Après-midi d'un faune, an exquisite work of music. So you have these two things balancing, this terrible, dreadful anti-Semitism and judicial cruelty, and this exquisite music in the Salle d'Arcourt, where Picard, I imagine in my novel, I'm sure he didn't, but it's legitimate for me to imagine that as a music lover, Dreyfus went down at 6:30. At 8:30, Debussy arrived at the Salle d'Arcourt. It seemed to me perfectly legitimate that Picard did too. And also, you know, the visit of the Tsar, the fact that the French army senior command were mostly obsessed with that, not with this wretched Jew on Devil's Island. That was what they were concerned about. I've never really seen a history of the affair make that point particularly, but it seems to me quite important. And also, and this is was a gift for a novelist, on the day that Picard, or the week that Picard took over as head of the statistical section in 1895, Paris was under what was known as the Great Stink. There were problems with the drains in Paris, and it was so bad that people could only venture out of doors with a handkerchief pressed to their nose. It may seem like a piece of clumsy symbolism to have Picard go into the statistical section on that day, but nevertheless, that is what was happening in Paris at that time. So this is what you can do as a novelist. You can be subjective. You can try and make the reader feel what it was like, the smell of the streets, the configuration of the officers, the people, the climate, all of those things you can use to try and bring a story alive. Why do the Dreyfus affair in this way? I think, and why is it important, and why should one feel attracted to it now? It seems to me that when I started looking at it, I thought that there was nothing to be said about the Dreyfus affair that was very interesting in terms of anti-Semitism after the Holocaust. I mean, you know, so there was this event in Paris in the 1890s. What does that compare to Auschwitz? But you can see in the Dreyfus affair the first faint drumbeats that lead to the dreadful, murderous anti-Semitism that comes later in Germany. And from the same source, the humiliation of the defeat in 1870. Prior to that, there was not much in the way of anti-Semitism in France. After it, when a great nation is defeated on the battlefield, there's a search for scapegoats. So, you know, what has gone wrong with French manhood? Why have we been defeated by this newly created united Germany? And that led to a feeling that society was somehow being corrupted by all these people with money, and that the values were wrong, and they got inside the French army in some way and bought their way in. And when the affair was at its height, synagogues were burnt, Zola's books were burnt, effigies were burnt in the street, Jewish shop windows were smashed, anti-Semitic caricatures were put in the French press. All the things that we associate with Germany were happening in Paris in the 1890s. And after 1914, after 1918, again, you have Germany, a great military nation, defeated on the field of battle, a sense of a stab in the back, and the whole process begins to repeat all over again. So the Dreyfus Affair is interesting for that reason, it seems to me, as a precursor of what was to come. It's about racial prejudice, this affair. If Dreyfus hadn't been a Jew, I don't believe for a second that he would have been picked out and accused of being the traitor on such flimsy evidence. If Dreyfus hadn't been a Jew, he wouldn't have been subjected to what was essentially rendition. That is, he was whisked off the streets and put into solitary confinement. And it was perfectly clear why the French army officers did this. They thought that what they called upper Jewdom, if they knew that one of their own had been arrested, would agitate for his release, and on the secret channels that they had, they would ensure that he got free. This was how they felt. Dreyfus was then subjected to a terrible regime of what we would call torture in solitary confinement. Even the military governor of Paris didn't know that Dreyfus was in his prison. He was awoken in the middle of the night. He was made to write out endless copies of the bordereau. He was harangued. He was deprived of sleep. He was deprived of contact with his family. He wasn't allowed to see a lawyer for weeks and weeks. These are techniques which I'm afraid are all too familiar and have been all too familiar in the West's fight against Islamic terrorism. The secret trial he was subjected to. One thing that this affair convinced me of is that secret justice is no justice. It can never be. There can only be justice when there's a great deal of scrutiny. Because if justice has to be seen to be done, in the words of the cliché. The press have to be there, the public, if they want to go, have to be there to see it. Only when there's that level of scrutiny, the weight of light being brought to bear, is the case sufficiently strong. Otherwise, there's a natural tendency to just nod it through. And this blanket use of the words national security to short-circuit the justice system is at the heart of what went wrong with the Dreyfus Affair. We have the secret evidence that was passed to the judges, only four or five documents that they were given. And if ever there was a dodgy dossier, believe me, that was it. And it was handed to the judges without Dreyfus or his lawyer knowing that the evidence was being considered. The judges saw it and they convicted on the basis of it, and Dreyfus and his team never had any opportunity to challenge that evidence, which turned out to be a tissue of lies. This we have seen happen so many times with the Birmingham Six, the Guildford Four, one of the victims of that miscarriage only recently dead, who saw his father die in jail. This is exactly the same as what happened in the Dreyfus case. We also have, indeed, such bizarre similarities as imprisonment on a remote island, away from spying journalists, away from lawyers, away from families. And it's clear that what was intended to happen to poor Dreyfus, who was imprisoned on Devil's Island, which is about 10 or 15 miles off the coast of South America, was that he should die there. He had five armed guards watching him all the time, and they were not allowed to speak to him. He couldn't even ask them when the next mail delivery was likely to come. He was utterly alone, and when he was brought back to Paris or back to France eventually, he found it very difficult to speak because his vocal cords had begun to atrophy. He found it quite hard to talk. We have a most extraordinary cover-up. You would think that when Picard discovered what he'd found, the whole thing would very quickly be sorted out. I think that he felt just common sense dictated that surely the French army would recognize it was better to bring this guy home and arrest the guilty man rather than let the spy continue to walk free in France and leave an innocent man on Devil's Island. But no, the French government refused, or the French military refused to revisit their error. And it took years. It was not until 1906 that Dreyfus was finally freed, and the only two men who were ever prosecuted in connection with the Dreyfus affair were Dreyfus and Picard. Picard himself ended up serving a year in solitary confinement because he was so determined to bring the truth to bear, and his enemies in the French General Staff were so determined to stop him. And in a very, very small way, I do think that in the case of the hapless Andrew Mitchell, Chief Whip, in this country, you see again the astonishing reluctance of those in power ever to admit their mistakes. It has to be dragged out of them piece by piece, and still in that case it's not over. It's amazing how long these things take. The two other similarities I would just mention: one is the fact that Picard was really the first great whistleblower in the modern world. The Dreyfus Affair couldn't have taken place, really, 30 or 40 years earlier. The Dreyfus Affair depended on there being a mass democracy, depended on there being mass circulation newspapers, telegraphs, photography, telephones, motor cars. It was a product of the modern age, and Picard was the first modern whistleblower, the first in a long and honourable line. I have mixed feelings that most of us probably feel about Edward Snowden. But really, the Picard case is comparable to Snowden with one difference. Picard was the equivalent of the head of the NSA. It's as if the head of the NSA had decided to blow the whistle. And the other and perhaps final thing I would say, the similarities or the points one should take from the Dreyfus Affair to our modern world, is that this affair was only exposed because of a free press. And a scurrilous and pretty unpleasant press it was in Paris in the 1890s. They were the ones that whipped up racial abuse. They were the ones that printed the anti-Semitic caricatures. They printed lies and filth. They behaved very, very badly. And the other side, the Dreyfusards, you could say, also did the same, because they got hold of secret love letters that Esterhazy, the true spy, had written many years before to his lover, and completely illegally printed these and helped destroy Esterhazy's character. And Zola was prosecuted for criminal libel for a work for Jacques, which blew the whole affair wide open. You have to take the rough with the smooth, in my view. That's the conclusion I came to about the French press there and our press now. Liberty is liberty and not another thing, and it often has very ugly manifestations. But if you brought in any system of control on the French press in the 1890s, I wonder whether you would have had Dreyfus freed, because the great and the good were all agreed that it was better the affair was left quiet. So those are the points that I think drew me to this story, subconsciously in a way, when I came across Picard in the great scheme of the Dreyfus Affair. That's why I wanted to write it as a novel. Now I hope that Polanski will go on and make it as a film. He's waited and waited, but now he's busy at work on it. And I hope that the film will eventually take place. I know that quite often these films don't, but I hope that this will happen. There's certainly a sense of urgency you get when your director is 81. And really, that's all I would wish to say about it. I do believe that the Dreyfus Affair is important, And I think that the best way that we can honour the memory of Alfred Dreyfus, who suffered so nobly, endured and survived, is to try to keep an eye on protecting the freedoms which hopefully make it impossible for the same thing to happen here. Thank you very much.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.